Arianna Huffington declares her last act. MPEG declares the need for royalty-free video. Sony declares iTunes is holding them hostage. And Egypt is overthrown by Al Jazeera. Right here on This Week in Media, number 222. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to This Week in Media. This is Alex, and we have an illustrious collection of co-hosts here today. Coming in from Connecticut, Lon Seidman. Hey, Lon.
How are you, Alex?
I'm doing very well. Is it snowy there, or is it...
You know, I'm so excited because I can see the ground again, and it's been months. At least it felt like months. So the snow is slowly retreating into mud.
Very, very good. And from Hollywood, California, Morgan Brown. Hey, Morgan.
Hey, Alex. Don't have the same problem out here, so...
Yeah, I was just there over the weekend. I was in Beverly Hills over the weekend, and it was a little bit nicer than it is. Even up here, it's all rainy in San Francisco. So anyway, we've got a lot of news coming up here, and one of the biggest story I think of last week was the ouster of Mubarak in Egypt, which you know we think of that as a political story, but that really is a media story. This has been kind of a viral infection that has afflicted Northern Africa and in the Middle East for the good, I think, of the people. But it's happening all over, and it looks like a lot of this has been driven by media sites. Morgan,
I agree. I think Twitter and Facebook are getting a lot of play in the tech press, but really, for me, the change agent has been Al Jazeera.
Yeah,
it's unbelievable what they've been doing.
Well, and I think what's interesting about that is that, and Lon, you can let me know what you think of this. But what's interesting about the whole Al Jazeera thing is that it's very hard to find Al Jazeera in the United States. Al Jazeera English, in my opinion, is probably one of the best global news networks around. I mean, you just get much greater perspective on what's happening in Africa and in Southeast Asia, et cetera, from Al Jazeera than anywhere else. It's great production quality. It was all helped, you know, they set it up with folks from the BBC, and it just feels like the BBC, except with, you know, that they're bent on things. Now, Al Jazeera Arabic, we bombed them in Iraq in 2002 or 2003. And so we did not, want anything to happen from Al Jazeera Arabic. But it looks like they're the ones that are actually, I mean, in a lot of ways, stoking the fire. Lon?
Yeah, it seems that's how a lot of it's getting out there. And I think the big story here, you know, as you've said before, Alex, too, that the video cameras are like a howitzer in modern formation of democracies, right? And I think that's got a lot to do with what's going on. And it's also interesting too that these are nations that have not had a free press, and Al Jazeera is kind of a stateless news organization. I know it's based out of Qatar, if I'm not mistaken, and you know it is kind of operating outside the rules that a lot of these regimes have put into place for controlling information. And I think it's having an impact. You know, with satellite television as popular as it is in the Middle East, they have very little control over what media people are consuming now. And the big story here for me is that you have a tremendously large population in all of these countries, in Egypt and in Iran and other places, that are tremendously educated and unemployed.
Yeah,
all of those things equal a movement that we're seeing here.
Well, and one of the things is the interesting technological problem. I spend a lot of time in Africa, and one of the things that you end up with is that the local production value in many of these countries is very low, you know, compared to international standards for news. And I'm just talking about the quality of the cameras and the organization of the shows and everything else. And so the local production tends not to be very high. The infrastructure that gets that picture to everyone is not very high. And so as a result, most people just get satellite dishes. I mean, that's just kind of what they, you know, all over Africa, you see people getting satellite dishes because that's the only way they get DSTV and they get whatever there's there. And Al Jazeera is part of that, BBC, CNN. So they're seeing all of that. And a lot of it is because the countries didn't invest in the infrastructure to really have that work for the population. The population is spending more money. And as a result, it's just almost impossible for them to, I mean, they can turn off the internet, which they tried. But it's very, very hard to turn off the satellite dishes, which has made it without turning off the electricity. And but I think that the interesting thing here is that we're really looking at a situation where you see success in one country is causing excitement in other countries. You know, so there's this chain reaction that's occurring that seems to be largely driven right by the media. You know, if they didn't know it was happening, they wouldn't know that it was possible. You know, if Iranians hadn't seen Mubarak be ousted, they wouldn't start to, start rioting. You know, if that makes sense. Morgan, do you think that we're going to continue to see this in the Middle East continuing to expand?
Yeah, I think so. For the time being, I think people are emboldened by success, and so we hear rumblings in Algeria, and we have people in the streets in Iran, and I think that we will see it. And I think, one of the things that was fascinating to me is growing up and watching, the Gulf conflicts on CNN. I thought that was groundbreaking, and now I've been watching Al Jazeera on my iPhone. Al Jazeera, not only as a news organization, but as a media organization capitalizing on creating awareness. They were live tweeting everything. They bought promoted trends on Twitter. Their video stream quality was excellent the entire time, I'm sure under massive, massive bandwidth demands. And so the way that they, they were reading tweets on their newscasts, they had the best experts in the area. So everything that they did, not just on the news gathering and being in the right place, but even as a media organization, they started the Demand Al Jazeera hashtag, to get some awareness with cable operators here in the States. So all of that was very fascinating to me. And I'm sure we will see more of this take place, show up.
Lon, I mean, one of the things for every news organization, there seems to be this thing that defines them, that brought them to the foreground. I mean, they've been building and working. So for instance, Nightline, it was the hostage crisis. For CNN, it was the first Iraq war.
Right.
Do we think that this interaction is that moment for Al Jazeera?
I think so. And I'm very curious to see how their editorial policies will change as a result, or if they have. I mean, I remember during the 9/11 crisis, it was a very different message that was getting out to the rest of the Arab world there, and now we're seeing Al Jazeera carrying the message of these democratic movements going on throughout the Middle East. And I think this is going to be their defining moment without question. And in fact, it sets them up for being the free press of the Arab world once these transitions occur. We've seen it in Egypt already. There's as Morgan pointed out, there's a lot of other of these movements really beginning to get some steam out throughout the Middle East. And I think that's going to be their defining area there. I keep coming back to the visions the images we got from Eastern Europe in the late 80s, where walls were coming down and major network news was carrying those pictures across the world. And I think Al Jazeera is going to be doing the same for the Arab world moving forward. And their role and their responsibility is going to be a lot different than it has been.
So it'll be very interesting to see how this goes. I mean, there's a Chinese curse of may you live in interesting times, and it looks like
yes,
it looks like the Middle East is definitely there right now. Also coming, I mean, we have a lot of course, online news. Hulu. Now, this is according to StrategyEye.com. According to ComScore, Hulu is twice as popular as the TV sites. So in quarter four, internet users watched 19.4 billion minutes of video on Hulu, compared to just 9.7 billion on ABC, CBS, NBC, Fox, and the CW sites. Overall, online viewing increased by 32% in 2010. 88.6 million on average watching online video in December, compared to 60 million. It's hard to believe we're talking about millions anymore. When we started this, it was, hundreds of thousands of people are watching video on the internet, and now it's, kind of building up. Now, do you think that the individual sites can really compete with aggregators?
I really don't think so. I think they've really put themselves in a rock and a hard place, because the networks don't want to necessarily drive a ton of traffic, to their website. They've kind of treated their web presences as the backwater, right, for so long that they've put scraps up there. They've put, reluctant to put programming up there. So, and then Hulu, in the meantime, has built a great brand. People are well aware of them. Their user experience is exceptional. The technology they deliver video on is exceptional. And so they have a huge head start. And I still think it will be tough for the networks to say, you know, hey, go watch this here, because it cuts into their core business. So I think it's going to be tough.
Lon, do you think that is there a business model that makes Hulu make sense for these broadcasters?
That's the problem. And, you know, the model that exists now in the regular TV world is you syndicate or you sell your show and you work out some kind of deal that way. This one, it looks like it's more of a revenue share. And I don't know how much the networks are going to like that. The problem they're in now with Hulu really taking off. Remember, we used to all pan Hulu when it first showed up, right? It was kind of a joke, and now it's the real deal. And aggregation is what people like. You know, we don't need these buckets to go to anymore. Viewers are flocking to aggregators across the board, and that's going to be a problem. And I think the people that want to compete in that space, who are okay with being aggregated, might end up with more eyeballs in the end. You know, I'm looking at ABC now pulling back shows that they used to offer online that they're no longer offering online on Hulu or on their own service too. So they're gonna have a hard time trying to make the kind of money they're making with broadcast now in this new world.
Morgan, do you think they can pull back? I mean, the issue is that more and more people are cutting the cord, more and more people are not watching TV. Is this something, are they getting themselves into another situation like the music industry where they pull their, you know, put their feet into the ground for too long and end up losing control?
Yeah, I think so. I think we're starting to see, you know, different innovative ways to try to tackle the problem. No one's really cracked the nut. But I think, you know, these networks have massive assets and they need to figure out a way to leverage them that doesn't, you know, kill their core legacy business. And I'm not sure if that's possible. Not smart enough to solve that one. The only, you know, the one kind of antithetical part of kind of the destination viewing is I see kind of with sports, where, you know, people will go to NBC Sports to watch the live stream of the Sunday Night Football game, or they will go to CBS Sports to watch the March Madness tournament. So I think they do have some assets that, you know, still will drive people to their sites if they leverage them properly. I just don't think they figured it out.
Now, also in the news around all of this is Apple is still on top of online movies. And so they are, as far as the top online movie retailer, this is according to a Zippy Cart blog, for both the economic sell-through and the internet video on demand, despite a heavy drop in the percentage they control. So Apple had 74% of the market in 2009. They only have 64.5% in 2010. But the overall market increased by 60%. So it's growing really fast. Of course, they're going to lose some market share. But, you know, now Apple, of course, a lot of people are saying this is because the iTunes app is so easy to use. Now, here's the question that I have. It's fine for this to be a video, you know, Apple owning the video on demand, but I don't think this is really, are we comparing this head-to-head with Netflix? Or do you think that they're calculating that? It doesn't say anything here about Netflix. But it just seems like, as soon as I really had Netflix working on my TV, I kind of stopped buying movies.
Mm. Yeah, I was looking at this too, thinking, how is that possible? Because Netflix is just on so many more devices. I think this might be referring to people paying per view. Because mm-hmm. I can't see this Apple at this point besting Netflix on something that's basically free once you pay your monthly subscription there. So, but from a leverage standpoint, what's striking about this number is that if Apple were to offer a Netflix-like subscription service, they could very well catch up pretty quickly.
Well, now, and here's a question for you, Morgan. It does Apple have to move to that subscription service sooner than later before they, you know, start losing too much ground?
You know, I think it's a little too early to say. I don't think they have to move right this second. I think they have such a nicely groomed walled garden that people are very happy playing with in for the moment. So I know that I'm using Netflix and Hulu, you know, through my PS3, and I'm, you know, streaming stuff to my iPad. But my mom is very happy to rent a movie on iTunes, and she can't believe that she's gotten that far. And as long as there's, you know, kind of the mainstream customer base that's out there, they have some time to figure out if, when, and how they want to get into the streaming. I think right now they have plenty of cushion to figure out how they want to make that part of the Apple experience.
And I do admit one advantage, I mean, one thing that happens is you don't really, Netflix is not really a great solution until you have good bandwidth. So, you know, the buying them one at a time and letting them download while you're eating dinner, you know, or buying them in the afternoon and then letting them download if you have a slower connection, is going to get you a much better experience than Netflix. I think that's one of the issues. I know that when I had slow bandwidth, we didn't even consider Netflix at home because it was just too grainy and beat up. And then once we had a nice fast account, then of course Netflix looked almost as good as the stuff we were downloading from Apple. And so that, I think, makes a big difference. But we'll see how that, you know, it seems hard to believe as we start to see all the subscription services moving forward for that not to be a solution for Apple, but we'll see. Ariana Huffington says AOL is going to be her last act. Hopefully that turns out well for her. And of course, Huffington Post got $315 million for the acquisition from AOL. That's a big bet by AOL, by Tim Armstrong and AOL, to figure out how this is all going to work. Morgan, do you think this is going to pan out?
You know, I'm really kind of skeptical about this, especially if we go back to the first story we talked about with the quality of news journalism that Al Jazeera has been doing around the Middle East. And then we talk about kind of the content farm strategy of some of our quasi, you know, press journalistic outposts on the web here. You know, AOL is making a huge bet. I think they're in it with two feet, which is admirable. And they're picking up some good assets and traffic. There have been some questions about how much they'll get for their ad rates and that type of thing. But if they're going to go the content route, which clearly they are, then I think this makes sense in that strategy. Whether that strategy wins remains to be seen.
So, Morgan, what do you think is going to happen with the interaction between the Huffington Post and TechCrunch?
All I know is I want to be in that first meeting when Huffington and Arrington sit down. I would love to be a fly on that wall.
It's going to be ugly. That's all I'm saying. Maybe not. It might be great. It would be kind of a fun meeting to see. So we'll see how that turns out. Now, a lot of this is, you know, a lot of stuff we're seeing right now is getting web to the video and getting web to the internet. And one of the big collisions that we've seen, it has been this issue that, for instance, Google has with putting up WebM and the VPA codec, because they just don't want to be dealing with the H.264 royalty encumberments. Now, what's happening now, this is according to Honline.com, is that the MPEG meeting at the 95th Motion Pictures Expert Group, they've done this 95 times, MPEG Group was held in at the end of January in Korea, and the group announced that it plans to issue a call in March for proposals for video compression technology that would have what is known as a Type 1 licensing, which is a standard, which would mean that there's a new standard that is intended to be royalty-free. So it looks like they're actually reacting to the to the issues related to royalty free. Morgan, do you think this is going to make a difference to blunt Google's move?
You know, I think I was on the show about a month ago, Alex, when we first kind of talked about Google's WebM play, and you mentioned that folks like MPEG LA would start to, you know, sniff around. And so I think we're starting to see some of that where, you know, MPEG LA was like, well, we're going to start to look through the WebM, you know, spec for patents and royalties. And so I think that, you know, the MPEG group is reacting, you know, as we could expect. And I think we were kind of headed down the H.264 path, and now we're going to see some more splintering until we figure out a way forward that kind of makes the big players happy.
And the thing we have to distinguish here is that the Motion Picture Experts Group, MPEG, is not connected to MPEG LA.
Right.
So,
exactly.
So it's
very confusing.
Right. So MPEG is the company that, you know, is a group that is announcing this call for a royalty-free solution. MPEG LA is the patent pooling company that is actually kind of holding the H.264. So there's this kind of back and forth between this process. Of course, what happens is that as a patent pooling company, there are many patents held by Sony, by Apple, by Microsoft, by all these companies related to how compression gets done. And they expect to get their 2 cents out of this. And that's why there's all this royalties, is because it's not like the MPEG created it. It's not like H.264 is owned by a single person. It's really this collection of patents that allow this to happen, which still puts the MWeb codec under some scrutiny, because we don't know whether they're going to be sued for any kind of infringements on top of the of what's actually happened. I mean, so that's going to be another issue to see. Morgan, do you think that the future is really just going to be, free, royalty-free streaming?
I think it's a bit utopian, because I think, it costs money to do all this stuff. And, Google's move, many have speculated, and I tend to agree, that it was, driven off the cost of the cost that they're paying out for the H.264
And to be clear, what the issue is here is that you don't pay for it now. I mean, royalties were dropped, for the video on the internet in August of 2010. But if you're a maker of a web browser or a video encoder, you're still paying for, you're still paying the MPEG group for that. And that's why, for instance, a lot of times you have applications that won't save out to H.264, is because the manufacturer doesn't want to pay the royalty that is required per application, for that encoder. So Google has a vested interest, because they're making a browser and they're kind of, they don't want to.
Right, it's Google's pain, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So we'll see how that turns out. Now, speaking of all of this, Sony is starting to they are starting to push back a little bit on iTunes. This is according to CNET News. They're talking about, head of Sony Computer Entertainment in Australia, Michael Efron was asked, is Sony going to continue to go through iTunes? And he said, if we do get mass take up, when does Sony need to provide content to iTunes? Efron asked in an interview, and he says, currently we do have to provide it to iTunes, as that's the format right now. But, he's starting to say, they're starting to, publishers are being held ransom by Apple, and if they are looking for other delivery systems, then we are waiting to see what happens in the next 3 to 5 years. So Sony is trying to get their own music solution, Music Unlimited, off the ground with 6 million songs, and trying to and pushing through that subscription service. Apple, of course, rejected Sony's application to the App Store for their book reader, saying that you don't have to put a subscription into the Apple Store or into the App Store, but you have to make it available. Now, here's an interesting thing that I haven't heard from anyone else talking about this process, is really the issue that of what Apple's talking about here is Steve Jobs, I think, actually put out a release, even though he's on vacation. He put out a release to clarify some of this. And the issue is that what Apple's saying is, if you bring your own customers to the game, you keep 100%. That's not a problem. You can have people order outside. You can have people do that stuff. If Apple is contributing to your bottom line by having people do in-app purchases related to that, so they came, they bought, they have an Apple device, they have the Apple App Store, then Apple, deserves 30%. Of that, because they're bringing that customer to you. That's Apple's argument. Morgan, do you think that this is viable?
Well, I think the argument is specious at best, because, for example, I'm a Pandora customer. My subscription is with Pandora. However, if I am on my iPhone listening to Pandora and I get a reminder that my subscription expires and I, now complete it through the app gateway, whose customer is that really? And I think that's a little bit more of a clear-cut case that, okay, this is a renewing customer. But I think in general, that's shaky ground, especially for the companies that rely on these subscriptions. And we have seen Apple do such a phenomenal job of locking people in with their device software.
But I think part of the thing is they're locking people in with ease of use. I have to admit that I'm getting to the point where I don't want to buy. I'm switching a bunch of stuff from one computer to another. I need a travel laptop, so a little 11-inch Air, for next week, and something that's a lot lighter than my 13-inch. And so I'm moving stuff over and reinstalling everything and putting all that stuff together is just insanely complicated on my end. And I have to admit that I popped up iTunes on my 11-inch Air, and it says, you've bought all these apps from the App Store, do you just want us to install them on this machine too? And I was just like, oh.
You're like, absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I don't want to. It was at that moment where I was like, I do not want to buy any more apps on the web. Like, I don't want to buy anything from these people. I just want to buy it from one place that keeps track of it all.
I agree. I'm very cozy in my confines. I think most people are too. And so I think that's tough because
it's kind of like, if this is a prison, beat me, but tie me up first.
Right. Exactly. So I think it's going to be very hard I think as more people get kind of disenchanted with Apple taking their share, there'll be more pressure, but, the consumers, we love the experience. So,
Right. Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see how this turns out. Now, speaking of books, we have the Sony Reader. Borders Bookstore, getting ready for Chapter 11. This is according to the Wall Street Journal. Borders Bookstore Incorporated is in the final stages of preparing a bankruptcy filing, into clinching the long fall of a company with humble beginnings that helped change the way Americans buy books. I mean, Borders Bookstore for me was, that was the place that I went a long time ago. And I have to admit that I only go in for an emergency and usually I can't find what I'm looking for. that's really been the challenge, that they've had. It looks like they are, they have tried to get their online stuff working. It hasn't really succeeded. Less and less people are walking in to buy anything. It looks like I think one of the issues is they have these long leases. And so one of the reasons they have to, they can't get out of some of the locations because, they have long leases there that they're going to have to kind of, and that's part of the bankruptcy will allow them to, renegotiate a lot of that. So it doesn't mean that Borders is going away, but Morgan, do you think that they can really recover from this?
I don't think so. I think, there was a lot of excess in the late 90s, 2000s with retail, and I think Borders was certainly part of that. They have a ton of debt. They have not done anything innovative with their web or digital properties. I think, the companies that ceded control of their stores to Amazon, Borders, Toys R Us, in which Toys R Us recently took back, but, they made some grave strategic errors that put them behind the curve. And so I think that what Barnes & Noble has done and what Amazon have done is just going to make it too hard for Borders to exist in any type of large capacity. They might go back to being a smaller regional player if they're lucky, but I don't think they have it in them.
It'll be interesting. I'm not sure if any bookseller has it in them. I mean, that's the challenge. I mean, I haven't bought a book this year, and I used to buy books every week, and I'll buy a couple magazines here and there. But now that the Apple subscription service, which we're, that we should talk about a little bit, has been announced, I have a feeling that a lot of my magazine subscriptions will be going that way. I mean, I'm a big fan of the new Daily. Have you checked out the Daily?
I have checked out the Daily only on the Daily Indexed, though, which is the brilliant tumble log that links to all the web versions of the articles for free. So, I have not splurged and downloaded that app just because it seems the Daily to me, the reporting doesn't seem amazing. I'm more of an economist fan than a, kind of a magazine format. So,
What I think is interesting about the Daily and why I'm watching it, because I have to admit, my primary reading is Wired, The Economist, Macworld, Cinefix. That's kind of those are the four magazines that I'm usually going to be tooling through, and maybe Foreign Affairs, but that's about it. And the issue is that I think that the Daily is the first one that we've seen that is a real try at something new. That isn't, we're not trying to take a magazine format and shove it onto the iPad. We're creating something new, that is built for the iPad and doesn't have to look like anything else. So I think that's the thing that we're, that I'm most interested in, related to that. So we'll see how that turns out. Anyway, that's it for this week. We lost, just in case you're wondering why Lon got so tired. It's not that we're upset with him or he's upset with us. We lost Lon in the middle of the show. And so Morgan and I shouldered on. But I'm sure we'll get Lon on in a near future episode. So thanks to Lon for stopping by. Morgan, where can people find you?
They can find me on Twitter. My handle's @MorganB.
Great. And this mess that you've been listening to is This Week in Media. We are over and out.